I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, Episode 43, Fathers in the Canon.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became a chronicler.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Bigger Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Hello, and welcome to another episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
And I'm Burt Wolder.
And together we sit here on the edge of our seats, at the edge of the microphone, bringing you everything that springs from our cosseted craniums.
Yes, crania. I thought you sat. Wait a minute. Aren't you sitting over there, and aren't I sitting over here? Yeah, that's right. Okay.
Yes, yes. We sit together.
Yes.
Yet apart.
Yet apart. It's amazing.
The power of the intertubes brings us together.
Yes.
And
on Father's Day, nonetheless.
On Father's Day, and we'll get to that in just a minute. Yes. But before that, we have a little bit of housekeeping to do, as Martha is wont to ensure. As we go to press, as the theme song says, we, of course, would love to tell you about a couple of our – of course, Wessex Press. I actually just came back from a short holiday and had a chance while I was on the plane and in a couple of fleeting moments when the kids weren't tugging at me to finish A Study in Celluloid, that book that's a producer's account of the Granada Sherlock Holmes series by Michael Cox. Very, very interesting read from the insider's perspective as to what it was like on the set there and the struggles they had to deal with, the filming locations, lots of factoids there about A Study in Celluloid and Jeremy Brett. So highly recommend that book. Get over to WessexPress.com. Check it out, as well as probably a few other things. I don't know if there's anything there that caught your eye, Bert.
Well, thanks to you. Yes, I have my copy here of The Illustrated Speckled Band, the original 1910 stage production in script and photographs. And the cover of this book, which is available from the Wessex Press, has that moment with Holmes' stick in hand where the dreaded snake actually appears. So you can see how they
Spoiler alert.
That Julie Taymor-like staging of the robotic snake in 1910 on stage. It's worth the book just to see the cover.
That's great. So get on over to WessexPress.com and tell them that iHose sent you. The other sponsor we, of course, would love to tell you about is none other than the Baker Street Journal, the leading Sherlockian publication since its founding in 1946 by Edgar W. Smith. You heard their gas lamps here before on these very airwaves, but there's much, much more underneath those yellow covers.
Yes, and an opportunity for you to participate. You know, there is no end, happily, to the questions that come from the stories and cases of Sherlock Holmes. Inconsistencies, odd consistencies, historical connections, points that are perhaps subject to alternative interpretation. All of this is fodder for people like you, if you feel a mind to write a scholarly paper and get deeper into the fun of our overriding interest in Sherlock Holmes. So it's another good reason for subscribing.
Yes, there are many, many reasons, and we'll enumerate each of them as the shows roll on. But get yourself a subscription. It includes five issues. That's four quarterly issues plus the Christmas annual. And every year the Christmas annual is a mystery. It's kind of the Christmas mystery when you think about it. You don't know what it's going to be until right before publication time. Mm-hmm. So it's like a surprise inside the cereal box.
Surprise inside the cereal box. Boy, you must be old. I read about those when I was when I was a kid, but we didn't have any surprise. The only surprise we had, you know, were those little bits of nutshell that cracked our teeth.
Well, nuts are banned now in this day and age, so I'm afraid you'll have to go elsewhere for those.
Thanks to Mayor Bloomberg.
So those are our sponsors, the West Express and the Baker Street Journal. Check them out. Of course, BakerStreetJournal.com and WestExpress.com.
Yeah.
So, Bert, as you said, today is Father's Day.
Yeah, like you said.
Yes. So,
and it's a good opportunity to pause and take a look at fathers in the canon. And you know, Watson's literary agent, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, had one might say a relationship with his father, as sort of a father-son relationship that colored much of his life. And for those who believe that Sir Arthur wrote the Sherlock Holmes stories, sort of an odd conclusion to come to, but for those who believe that to be the case, you can see in several of the characters in the canon who appear as fathers echoes of that sad relationship. I mean, the simple summary is that his father, Charles Doyle, was a fellow who I think found it difficult to find his way in the world and spent his last days in an institution owing to perhaps alcoholism and epilepsy. Mm. And that led to certainly a very strong and deep relationship that Conan Doyle enjoyed throughout his entire life with his mother. But I think we can find echoes of perhaps flawed father figures abounding in the canon.
Yeah, and before we get to some of these father figures, and frankly, there are some notable father figures as well as some deplorable father figures in the canon. We actually literally saw Charles Doyle's influence spring to life in the canon, I believe, in his last bow. When Holmes went overseas and took an alias, his alias was Altamont.
Mm-hmm.
And Charles' middle name was Altamont, Charles Altamont Doyle. So there Sir Arthur was paying a bit of an homage to his father in an actual name, as well as in some of the characterizations that we're going to see here.
Yeah.
So how would you like to do this? We have a checklist of sorts, but maybe we should talk about themes.
Mm-hmm.
And how fathers fit into certain themes. And since this is Father's Day, a day in which many of us honor our fathers or honor the memory of our fathers in some cases, why don't we talk about the handful that we were able to find that were actually good examples in the canon?
Yeah,
there seem
true.
to be less of those than of the other kind, but
that's true. Well, you know, it's very tempting when you write up the records of a case to sort of paint things in black and white, and in those kinds of circumstances, stepfathers and other fathers who have ulterior motives and nefarious interests sometimes loom very large. But we could start with John Ferrier from Study in Scarlet, who was not an actual father, but whose adopted daughter, Lucy, he felt enormously protective of and, in fact, gave his life for his daughter.
Yeah, I had only thought about their beginnings of how he picked her up in the desert as the wagon train kind of died out. They were the only two left, of course, and mm-hmm. he hoisted her on his shoulder. Well, he found her first, this kind of little sack of colored clothing, uncovered her and took her on his shoulder and carried her to safety. But as you said, the ending was rather tragic. It was probably one of the sadder stories in the canon in terms of familial ends. Mm. You know, of course, The Dancing Man is another very sad one in terms of husband and wife meeting their ends. But this was rather sad too, as his daughter was taken from him. And as you say, he laid down his life for her to protect her.
Mm. Yeah, and you know, he was a very noble character. Of course, it's a mix of his own growing disaffection or his own disaffection with the it's difficult because you can't really say the Mormon faith. It's sort of the characterization of the Mormon faith that's presented in those tales, with a emphasis on polygamy, of course. But it was his disaffection with that and his abhorrence of that and his determination to allow his daughter to choose her mate that led him to abandon everything and run for safety.
Yeah, you talk about the two suitors who were hotly contesting Lucy Ferrier's hand, Enoch Drebber and Joseph Stangerson. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they talk about the elders in the church there. And it doesn't sound like they were exacting any kind of fatherly duty over their sons to help teach them right from wrong. It was it sounded like every man for himself out there at a certain point.
It's wonderful, though, you know, if you have not read A Study in Scarlet lately, it would be great to go back and reread it, because you know, you really I mean, depending on your own reaction to it, of course. I just looked at it within the last couple of days, and I had not read it for a long while. And you really have to admire the prose writing and the characterizations. Now, you know, admittedly, it's sort of a fanciful depiction of mid-19th century life in Utah. But, you know, the characters are very real and vibrant. It's very exciting. There isn't a dull moment on the page. And it was really written by a very talented writer. And I think... you know, you can still feel some of the impact of it today.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, I'm not sure if this is still available for publication, for if it's in print. You can actually go to the BakerStreetJournal.com site and check it out. There was a play that Conan Doyle wrote mm-hmm. after A Study in Scarlet called The Angels of Darkness. And it was basically looking at this Mormon, this Utah episode of A Study in Scarlet. Again, this is something that was written over 100 years ago, so the accuracy with regard to the Mormon faith could be questioned. But it's a great example of something that goes a little farther afield in terms of the canon and is well worth checking out. And I believe that one of the previous Morley Montgomery Award winners, which is the best article as judged by a panel of judges every year, the best article in the Baker Street Journal in 2000 was – you can actually find it as a PDF on the website. It's called Who Wrote the American Chapters of A Study in Scarlet? And I actually heard him give that paper at Autumn in Baker Street in the late 90s, I believe,
Who gave the whose papers then?
It was Ben Vazosky.
Oh, right.
Yeah. So I highly recommend checking that out if you can.
And then, you know, after John Ferrier, there are, of course, looking for noble father figures. Well, I suppose... Robert Ferguson in Sussex Vampire is an example of a noble father.
Yeah, that's a tough one when you think about it. Because here's a man who has one child, And his first wife passed away. And of course, the first child is absolutely devoted to his father. And the father takes a new wife, a woman of South American descent. And you know, when a South American is involved in the canon, it's always something to be questioned. We saw that in The Hound of the Baskervilles. We saw it in Thor Bridge. We see it as well in The Sussex Vampire. Introduction of a South American figure involves mystery and suspicion. Mm. And, of course, by this new wife, Big Bob Ferguson has a baby. And without giving too much away, let's just say that there are competing factions for the father's attention. And, boy, when you've got two children who are dead set against each other in one way or another, and you have to make the step to let one of them go. In this case, it was a around-the-world cruise, which was not a pleasure cruise, but it was basically like sending a kid off to military school. That's a hard decision to make. And here Bob is torn between suspecting his wife and dealing with his kids. Mm. And I mean, there are plenty of parents these days who have lots to grapple with in terms of the horrors of the world around us and teaching their kids right from wrong and about the influences out there. And of course, everyone is much more watchful of their children these days than, say, when you and I grew up, Bert.
Yeah.
And we could wander streets until dark and, you know, the neighbors would look after us. It's a much different world out there. And to think that there are parents today that are juggling with these stresses and these decisions and difficult, well, whether it's punishments or consequences to deal with, this is really is nothing new, mm-hmm. as Doyle shows us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's true. Although, you know, at the outset, I think that Robert Ferguson is going to turn out to be a good guy because, after all, he played rugby for Blackheath. So, you know, and it was distant, had that sort of distant connection to Watson. So,
yeah,
he was bound to be a stout-hearted guy.
Yeah, there you go. You know, one of my other favorite father figures, and it's really encapsulated in just a short paragraph, is Grant Munro,
mm-hmm.
which to the casual reader, the reaction is, who? And it's from a story that really doesn't get a lot of attention either, and that is The Yellow Face,
mm-hmm.
Where he's convinced that his wife is hiding something from him, and she's from she's from the United States. Again,
another
mystery.
Another foreigner.
Yeah. You know, with the, foreigners in the canon are always treated with suspicion and mystery. But he followed his wife there and found that she was hiding something. And it turned out to be a child from her first marriage. And she was married to a guy by the name of Hebron of Atlanta, or Hebron from Atlanta,
mm-hmm.
Who was, I think he was a freed slave. Doesn't say in particular, but he was dark-skinned, and their daughter Lucy was even darker than he. And Grant Munro's wife was sent to share this with her husband. And then she came clean. She told him the whole story. And the part that really, really hits me is his reaction. And she says, now, you know all, and I ask a child in me. You know, she's putting it in his hands. And he said, or Watson says, it was a long 10 minutes before Grant Munro broke the silence. And when his answer came, it was one of which I love to think. He lifted the little child, kissed her, and then, still carrying her, he held his other hand out to his wife and turned towards the door.
Yeah, noble fellow and a lovely moment.
Absolutely. And of course, that's where Holmes
Norbury.
It says Norbury from. If I ever get overconfident in my powers or giving less pains to a case than it deserves, kindly whisper Norbury in my ear, and I shall be infinitely obliged to you.
Yeah, that's a great thing about Holmes. You know, his record is far from unblemished, particularly according to his own standards.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, even as a superhuman figure, he did have his faults. Hmm. And you know, that's really an interesting parallel, I think, to the whole topic we're talking about today. I think as children, we look up to our fathers in particular, and of course to our mothers as well, but just for the sake of the theme here, to our fathers as these superhuman figures. Mindy just had the kids fill out this form for me, and Will is 8 and Drew just turned 6. And they had to fill out how tall they thought I was, how much I weighed. And, you know, Will thinks I'm 6'2" and 190 pounds.
Well, as you are.
Well, I wish. A little shorter than that. Not too much under that in terms of the weight. I realized I have a problem I need to start working on. But the kids look up to you as a superhuman way. And at some point over the course of our lives, we find out that our fathers are fallible. They do have faults. They are human. They are not superhuman as we were wont to believe when we were children. And I think Holmes comes across that very same way.
Mm. Well, it's my favorite quote from Mark Twain, you know, which I never remember completely, but the gist of it was, when I was 17, Twain said, my father was so stupid that I could scarcely stand to have the old man around. But by the time I was 21, I was amazed at what he'd learned in 4 short years.
Oh, it's funny because it's true.
Well, and then you get into some of the more flawed father figures, including some of whom we hear only indirectly. In The Three Students, we are presented with a puzzle as to which of the students might have taken a peek at an examination paper before it was given. And we're introduced to one of them, who is, of the three, the most attractive and admirable. But you find out early on that his father was, I think, ruined on the turf, if I remember correctly. Sir Jabez Gilchrist. Mm. Was ruined on the turf. And that's another example. And that repeats, I think, throughout the canon, the flawed father figure who, for one reason or another, lost it all.
Yeah, and what's interesting here is in the very same story as we have the flawed father figure, we have the stand-in father figure, Bannister, mm. The manservant there at the school, promised Sir Jabez that he would look after his son. Not sure that he necessarily, sure that he did that. There's actually a passage in here where Hilton Soames, the tutor there, says, "I'm pleased to hear that you did not intend to profit by your unfair advantage. Why did you change your purpose?" Gilchrist pointed to Bannister. "There is the man who set me on the right path." Hmm. And that's Bannister standing in, almost like Alfred does in Batman, right? Standing in for Bruce Wayne's parents. I thought it would have been much, much more ironic if it were Gilchrist and Soames that were together. Just like the soap.
I wouldn't be surprised if that was the root of that name.
You think so?
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Conan Doyle stayed at a hotel and he loved the amenities there so much that he...
Well, no, but whoever dreamed up the soap used Gilchrist and Soames. What's the other one that presents as an old name but isn't?
Crabtree and Evelyn?
Yeah, Crabtree and Evelyn. Yeah, that's also, I don't think, very old.
That was named after Miss Crabtree from the Little Rascals.
Miss Crabtree from the Little Rascals.
No.
And Evelyn Anchors.
Yeah, so that's an example there in the three students. Let's go back to one of the longer stories, because this is really, to me, a real fascinating instance of fathers and how they interact with their children, and or perhaps how they don't. And that is The Sign of Four.
Mm.
We've got the Sholto brothers, who are twins, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And their father, Major Sholto. And then, of course, you've got Mary Morstan and her father, Captain Morstan.
Mm.
And both Sholto and Morstan were part of the original Sign of Four treaty there. And they, of course, escaped with some of the treasure. And before, well, I guess Morstan disappeared, and he died at. Did he die at the Sholto residence?
Yeah, yeah.
He died under mysterious circumstances, but Major Sholto wanted to make sure that his sons would take care of Miss Morstan after he passed, and that's why she kept getting those gems every month or so. So here was a father who was trying to right some wrongs from the past and trying to make sure there was an equitable split of the family, essentially the family fortune. And, well, we saw how that worked out.
Well, you know, there are these constant themes that cut through the cases of Sherlock Holmes. Like, you know, like father, like son. And one of the more vivid ones is Reigate Squires, where you have, you know, the evil Cunninghams, father and son. Who, who commit murder and who are only willing to do it again.
I don't know which one was worse than the other. I mean, they were equally as evil in their plans. They, of course, had to plot it together. That's how Holmes figured it out, piecing the looking at that scrap of paper that was still in Coachman Williams' hand and looking at the words and seeing that every other word alternated in handwriting. But the handwriting itself seemed to be related, much as Holmes has been able to discern that family members that people are family members by the similarity in their ears, for example. He was able to discern the same through their handwriting and also to determine that one was older than the other. So this was a plot that was hatched and very, very intricately and intimately planned between father and son in the Reigate, well, Squire or Puzzle, depending on which edition of the book you have.
And that stands in sharp relief from one of the happiest and most genial and most supportive fathers in the canon, good old Jeffro Rucastle, who admires his son and who provides him with a steady stream of cockroaches, apparently, to whack in the smithereens at their idyllic dwelling in where were they?
They were in the that was the Copper Beaches.
Yeah, yeah, but where was the
in Hampshire? Wasn't it in Hampshire?
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, actually, I've got an excerpt from our West Express friends' study in celluloid about Joss Ackland, who portrayed Jeffro.
Actor.
Oh, I still remember him from one of the Mel Gibson movies. Lethal Weapon 2, I think, where he was this evil South African ambassador, and he held up his passport and screamed out "Diplomatic immunity," and of course Mel Gibson shot him through the head. Let me go grab that copy of Study in Celluloid and read that excerpt about Joss Ackland as Jeffro Rucastle.
Yeah, please.
So Carolyn Bartlett was the casting director on this particular episode, and together with Paul, that is Paul Annett, achieved two striking successes. They had to cast one of the juiciest villains in the canon, and obviously needed a major character actor. When they secured Joss Ackland for Rucastle, we all breathed a sigh of relief. The part was in the safest possible hands. Now, if you recall, if you've seen that episode of the Copper Beaches, but from 1985, Jeffro Rucastle in the original Copper Beaches is described as telling a string of the most hilariously funny stories. There was no script. There was no, in the canon, there are no recountings of those stories. So they basically had to make it up. And essentially what they would do is they would, you know, look at him through the window. There would be a narrative over it. So you wouldn't actually hear the stories themselves until you got to the punchline. And then, you know, the punchline was something along the lines of, you know, and the duck said, you know, something along those lines. So we were left with what seemed to be an uproariously hilarious punchline. And, of course, you have on the one side this jovial, you know, mirth-inspiring, round little man who seemed to have, you know, when he hired a governess, 100 pounds a year, seemed to have all good intentions. And then, of course, little Edward, his son, his young son there walking around smacking cockroaches with the slippers. And our friend Ralph Hall from the Baker Street Irregulars, who I love. Mm. Ralph is from Kentucky. He is a BSI, and his profession is exterminator. And appropriately, his investiture in the BSI is smack, smack, smack. So there you see, much as Holmes inferred in some instances of people having snarling dogs, and he would infer their snarling attitude, he inferred the real motivations behind Jeffro Rucastle by observing his, or at least hearing about his young son and his killing of cockroaches.
Well, you know, it's that's an image that repeats in literature. I can't – of the, you know, the child torturing and killing insects. It's sort of a great literary signpost that all is not well here.
Indeed. Indeed. It's got like the canary in the coal mine.
Mm.
Well, I think we have two last father figures, both stepfathers.
Oh, who, yeah, the big ones.
Yeah, they give stepfathers a bad name. And that's bad.
That is bad.
So the first comes from A Case of Identity.
Yes.
Again, not one of the, you know, really talked about stories, but it was one of the early ones. I think this was the third in the adventures.
Oh, really? Is it that early?
If I recall correctly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Scandal in Bohemia, Red-Headed League, A Case of Identity. And this was interesting because it gave Holmes a chance to do some of his deductions in the sitting room simply by observing, what was her name? I'm blanking on it now. Miss Mary Sutherland.
Oh, right, Mary Sutherland.
Right, looking at her fingers and her gloves and her forehead and her shoulders and being able to deduce what she did and how she did it and whatnot. Fascinating example of Holmes. Holmes' ability at that point. But of course, as part of that, the story that she comes to us with is the story of Mr. Windibank, her father. Well, she corrects herself, her stepfather, and how he is encouraging her to stick around. And of course, she goes to the gasfitter's ball and meets Mr. Hosmer Angel, a man with tinted spectacles and a whispery voice and whiskers, a beard. Yes. And of course, it turns out to be her stepfather.
Astonishing.
And you know, how do you live with a stepfather and not recognize him when he's in such a flimsy disguise?
Oh, come on. You haven't seen the tinted spectacles.
No, this is like everyone looking at Clark Kent and not realizing he's Superman simply because he's wearing glasses.
What? But Superman doesn't wear glasses. yeah.
Now we're going to have to go off on a Jor-El tangent. Or a Ma and Pa Kent tangent.
Ma and Pa Kent.
No, but...
Great fathers, not in the canon, Jor-El.
Yes, there you go. I prefer the Marlon Brando Jor-El.
Marlon Brando Jor-El, yeah.
Sounded
a little bit like Truman Capote to me, the Marlon Brando Jor-El.
And of identity, actually foreshadowing a little bit of what we saw with the Cunningham a pair at Fields. We have a typewriter that Holmes is able to make deductions from, seeing that the typed notes that came – well, first of all, that her suitor was using a typewriter to write to her, how very personal, was interesting. But then Holmes found out that it was the typewriter from in her very house.
Yeah, there you go. Well, so, you know, this is the first time some of these things were done, you know, particularly using typewriter type and so on and those distinctive characteristics in a story.
Yeah. And do you remember the reason that Windebank wanted to keep Miss Sutherland in the household?
Well, it was money, wasn't it?
It always is. That was the same reason that that Rucastle wanted to keep Alice locked up.
Yeah.
And because, of course, he was remarried, right? And she was still getting some funds from her departed mother, mm-hmm. and sharing them with the family, of course. Happening with Miss Mary Sutherland.
Well, and also, Dr. Grimsby Roylott.
The last one we need to talk about. Yes. Grimsby Roylott, the Ophidian flake, who killed his stepdaughter using a snake. Yes. Roylott, I think, is probably one of the more interesting villains in the canon. Mm. More so than Professor Moriarty in some ways. Because we know just about as much of him as Moriarty. Because Moriarty really only makes an appearance in one story, although he's mentioned in two. But we get the backstory of Roylott pretty well. Mm. That he was a doctor in India. And his wife was killed in a railway accident. And that he was kind of drummed out of business because he beat someone to death. And then, of course, on his own property, when he moved back to England, he was sued because he threw the blacksmith over the bridge, and he kept a cheetah and a baboon on his property.
Yeah, and then afterwards, he did a series of one man shows where he talked about tiger blood and winning. And... oh no, wait! I'm sorry. That was somebody else.
Who had
anger management issues.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, but, well, Roylott was a terrific villain because he's one of the few. I mean, I think you point up something very interesting in the contrast between Roylott and Moriarty. Moriarty is an interesting villain because he's a professor. You know, he is a trusted academic figure. And to find that and typically... You know, professors are, as generally presented as characters in literature, don't have deep social skills. But here, and so frequently when you come across academics in literature, there's sort of less to them than meet the eye. But here, there's this magnificent entire other world behind Moriarty. And then, of course, his mathematical insights, his published papers, his insights into the dynamics of an asteroid, his great criminal accomplishments, the mysterious organization that he heads. You know, he's quite a, for his time, he was a genuinely frightening villain. It's very difficult today to make that same sort of character equally frightening, which is why you tend to see characters like the BBC Sherlock's Moriarty to be as terrifying, but in a very different psychotic way. And then you compare that to Grimsby Roylott, who is one of the few characters in the canon who has a looming large physical presence. And you have that whole magnificent scene about the bending of the poker, which gives Holmes an opportunity to straighten it out again, demonstrating that his strength is the equal. And but then overall, you know, he's a father, a stepfather who's murdered one child and eager to do it again. And then with the snake. So it's just a terrible combination. That was one of the first Sherlock Holmes stories I gave my oldest daughter when she was young, not thinking about how I would have come across that if I were a young girl to my own. All I could remember was what a great story it was.
Yeah.
You know, it shows you what an idiot I was.
Yeah.
It frightened the bejesus out of me.
I remember years ago on the hounds of the internet discussion forum, there was a young father who, I think he had sons that were probably about the age of my sons, about 6 and 8. And he read them The Speckled Band. And
oh my goodness, that's a
bedtime story.
Ooh.
Right? Even better. Let's lay down in the bed, as we've just talked about the snake coming down the bell pull into the bed. And the 8 or 9 year old was visibly terrified. And the 6 year old, as you know, the second child or the last child in the family, is, you know, typically happy go lucky. He doesn't fear anything because he's got the big brother or big sister to worry about. So they go to bed. And a few minutes later, the 6 year old makes a whistling noise. and the 8 year old comes running out of the bedroom screaming. Oh. But, you know, I mean, think about the kids, not just the snake image, but, you know, we bring our kids to the pediatrician's office. And the doctor is supposed to be this trusted figure, as you said, Bert. And Holmes in that story noted, he said, you know, when a doctor goes wrong, he's the worst of criminals. Mm. You know, he has the cunning and he has the knowledge that make him a formidable opponent. And in this case, you know, Roylott had the motivation. It was... total income at the time of his wife's death was a little short of £1,100. Each daughter can claim an income of £250 in case of marriage, and market rates brought that £1,100 down to £750. So it leaves the doctor with a relative pittance. So he had every motive to keep them in house, so to speak, and to keep them from marrying. And I've even heard of some scholarly works that have talked about they kind of look at the symbolism in The Speckled Man, although I'm sure Conan Doyle didn't intend this in terms of incest, you know, kind of the installation of a ventilator from one room to the other, and obviously using a snake. And that being the stepfather accosting the stepdaughter. It's actually an interesting argument to be made along those lines.
Yeah.
So I think that wraps up our rundown of some of the father figures in the canon. An interesting list it was.
Yeah, it is. And we also leave with probably the most interesting father figure, unrecorded, unreported, unsuggested, unreferred to, and that would be Holmes' own father, Holmes and Mycroft's father, which is another reminder of the fact that Holmes is somewhat unique in that we know virtually nothing about him, which is another reason why all the speculation and imagination around Holmes has been so fruitful for all of these years.
Do you know what William Baring Gould speculated Holmes' father's name to be in Sherlock Holmes of Baker Street, I think it was?
Was it Sigerson?
Sigur Holmes.
Oh, right, Sigur.
Because, of course, Holmes later, as he goes on hiatus, is Sigerson.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, people had interesting names there. Jeffro, Jabez, Sigur. You don't come across those today down at the 7-Eleven. When you're getting your big gulp, you know.
Not in New York, you're not.
You're not bumping into any Sigurs and Jeffros anymore.
Well, it sounds like it might be time. Editor's Gas Lamp.
Yes, Editor's Gas Lamp indeed. For this episode's Editor's Gas Lamp, we are going back to October 1958. And a gas lamp that Edgar Smith wrote called Truth is Better Than Fiction. And the reason why we've picked this one is that, in a way, the topic of fathers in the canon seems to be breaking new ground. There is not a lot that we could discover previously written and published in the Baker Street Journal and in other sources on that subject. But one of the things we all owe to our mothers and our fathers is our existence. And as Scott was mentioning earlier, we bear the very strong imprint of our fathers, and the durability and honesty of the character of Sherlock Holmes looms so large that it was the topic of Edgar's Editor's Gas Lamp when he wrote Truth is Better Than Fiction. A good many years ago, in November 1930, to be exact, Haywood Brown wrote an article for the Women's Home Companion entitled Sherlock Holmes and the Pygmies. In it, he spoke of the master as belonging to the ages and of the creatures of S.S. Van Dyne, Earl Durr Biggers, and Mary Roberts Reinhardt as typical of those fictional characters who stand ignominiously beneath him. This was a discerning essay, and if Mr. Brown had written it today instead of when he did, he could have made it more discerning still by amplifying his list to include whole legions of other detectives, hard, soft, and medium-boiled, who have come since upon the scene. For it is an unhappy fact that most of the figments of the mystery writer's imaginations present themselves to us as cardboard figures, stiff and flat and unconvincing, who move in their contrived postures without integrity and without reality. As Mr. Holmes looks down upon them, we can see him smiling with amusement and perhaps a mild indulgence. It may be granted that many good detective stories are being written today for our casual reading and entertainment. There is often good plotting and sometimes excitement and suspense, and occasionally an appealing environment and atmosphere. But there is improbability and implausibility, too. And most improbable and implausible of all, usually, is the central character himself, the reason for being of the detective story, which is to say, the detective. Do we really know these individuals? Or if we do, could we tolerate them for long outside the pages of the book in which they carry on? Would we like to sit with them by the fire, discussing the obliquity of the ecliptic? Do we have a sense of their personal characteristics, their age, their height, the color of their eyes and of their dressing gowns? Do we follow their mental processes and know their methods as we know our own? Not very often. There are, of course, a few exceptions, and one of them is Nero Wolfe, who is, and generously, three-dimensional. We can really see him buried in his armchair drinking beer or fussing with his orchids, and his mind works like a human being's and not like the tortured convolutions of a half-finished univac. And there are Dr. Thorndike and Hercule Poirot and Hildegard Withers, too, who might be people we really know. but reach as we can. The list is bound to be a short one. The fact remains that comparisons between the true and the false are invidious and illogical. There is no character in fiction with the dignity and reality of Abraham Lincoln or Albert Einstein. And there is no villain in any book so noxious and repelling as Adolf Hitler or James Moriarty or Lucky Luciano. There is no substitute in the invention for a Mozart or a Rembrandt or a Shakespeare. These men and their links also stand above the pygmies that other men have created, and they prove, if it need proving, that truth is not only stranger but more convincing than fiction. Sherlock Holmes, by this testimony, is a greater man and more vital and viable than anyone could have imagined.
You know, it's amazing to me, every time we pick out an Edgar Smith gas lamp, how ageless and timeless they are.
Yeah, and how beautifully put together, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And this is a guy who, after the war, was responsible for General Motors operations in Europe. But there is something of a great heritage of executives for major motor car companies being extremely literate people.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
but it is amazing, isn't it? It is amazing, you know, what he was capable of.
I would be interested to see, and I don't know if these exist anywhere in the BSI archives, to see if there were early drafts of Edgar's gas lamps, or if this was something that he did almost by dictation and was able to just rattle off, and if he was that facile with the word.
Oh, it's a great question. I'd love to see some of his rough drafts. You know, that is something I think about from time to time when we think about Conan Doyle and manuscripts and the literature of Sherlock Holmes. There are comparatively a lot of manuscripts about, and hardly a month goes by that you don't find out about this page and that page, and somebody's writing about Conan Doyle's secretary, about Major Wood writing this paragraph or that paragraph, or the handwriting is a little different. But and a lot has been written about Conan Doyle's own method of composition. You know, it was frequently remarked, and I presume it was true, that he could write anywhere. He would just sit down and write. But what we don't have are all of the notes, you know, the envelopes. Because maybe we do, but I've never seen hide nor hair of any of that. The notes on the backs of envelopes, the rough draft. You know, there's the one famous page that sort of reflects the birth of Study in Scarlet.
Right.
With Sherrinford Holmes and all of that on it. But nothing else.
Yeah.
And the manuscripts that exist are the manuscripts that were finally prepared for the publisher.
Right, yeah.
So what happened to the ones before that?
It's a mystery worthy of Sherlock Holmes.
Hey, and speaking of mysteries worthy of Sherlock Holmes, we frequently tell our listeners that we love their comments, and they can get those to us in a variety of ways.
Such as
giving us a call at 774-221-READ. That's 774-221-7323.
Of course, they can come to us via email at comment@ihearofsherlock.com.
And then go to our Facebook page. And
Facebook.com/ihearofsherlock.
Yeah.
Twitter, @ihearofsherlock on Twitter. And of course, the website, ihearofsherlock.com.
There's just dozens of ways. And we were lucky enough to get a call at 774-221-READ from one of our listeners, and we thought we would share that with you now, and here it is.
Hi, Bert and Scott. It's Ray Betzner. I was a little confused when Bert introduced his segment on the BBC team's visit to New York with a clip of the Beatles performing to a screaming audience on the Ed Sullivan Show. But the segue from the screaming masses of the 60s to the equally vocal fans for Benedict Cumberbatch and company soon made the reference clear. Well done. I know there are longtime Sherlockians who have concerns about the unbridled enthusiasm of this new crop of Holmes devotees, but I'm like you two and Steve Lachman at the Baker Street Journal. I look forward to seeing how their energy and creativity will become part of the more traditional Holmes movement. And I guess like them, I also believe in Sherlock Holmes. Take care. Keep up the good work. Bye.
Hey, wait, was that a swipe at us?
A swipe? How a swipe at us?
He said unlike.
Oh.
Did he say like or unlike Steve Rothman and us?
Oh, no. He said like. He said like.
Like. Like, oh, Steve, thank goodness.
Yes. Huh. Yeah, no, we love the Baker Street babes. And
we love babes of all sorts, but particularly
especially
the
Baker Street
variety.
Yeah. And love the enthusiasm for you know, this new rejuvenation of Sherlock Holmes. And have you seen the preview of the CBS show Elementary? I just saw that the other day.
Yeah, I had the same reaction as another Sherlockian friend who tends to be very traditional in his thinking. When we saw it, we both kind of looked at each other and said, "It actually doesn't look bad."
No, it looks very good. Looks like a lot of fun.
So if they can keep to the more of the scientific, the mystery solving, and the personalities around it, and not get into some sort of deranged love interest between the female Watson and Holmes, I think we'll have an interesting series on our hands.
Yeah. Well, I love the whole premise of bringing Holmes to life in the 21st century, and and it's interesting casting because, of course, Johnny Lee Miller has worked in the past with Benedict Cumberbatch. I think we talked about that in Frankenstein. So they both have a history on the stage of even swapping roles during the run of a play. So it'll be very interesting to see how this other character develops.
Yeah, and I think that in addition will kind of lead to some momentum toward an event I just heard about in the last few weeks, that is being mounted by, I believe, one of the Baker Street babes, called, I think it's being called a Sherlock Con, because they wanted to have an event where people could get together and meet with like-minded souls and discuss Sherlock Holmes, even though we already have one of these called the BSI Weekend. I think they wanted one that was more open or that felt like it was open to the masses. And it'll be interesting to see how that rolls out. And we will have coverage on that as the event begins to take shape. Perhaps we'll even be there. Who knows? But I believe it's scheduled to take place in April of 2013 in Atlanta.
Mm. Good. Well, we should do, a podcast with RD and the other babes and talk a little bit about it. That'd be great.
Absolutely. As we get more information on it and we can share it with our friends and fans and associates, we will absolutely be delighted to bring that to you. And of course, if there is anything that you would like us to cover, if there's anything we missed in today's episode, you know, if there was a father figure that perhaps we didn't mention or a topic that we glossed over or a glaring error in our insightful analysis.
Good God.
It doesn't seem possible, does it?
No.
We would love to hear from you. Keep us on the hot seat. We have lots of plans for future episodes. We're getting to them as best we can. I know travel schedules are always challenging, particularly in the summer, but by God, it's Father's Day and we managed to crank one out today.
Yeah. Excellent. Well, I think that brings us to the end of another great conversation, and all I can say is thank you, and I'm Bert Wolder.
And that must mean I'm Scott Monty, and the game's afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.